are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. Today is Monday, September 14th. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Rowan Jacobson, Vermont author and winner of the James Beard Award. Jacobson's most recent books are A Geography of Oysters, The Connoisseur's Guide to Oyster Eating in North America, and Fruitless Fall, The Collapse of the Honeybee and the Coming Agricultural Crisis. He has written for The New York Times, Newsweek, Harper's, Saveur, The Art of Eating, and others. His new book, The Living Shore, about our ancient connection to estuaries and their potential to heal the oceans, has just been published. His next project, American Terroir, will be released in 2010. He lives in Vermont with his wife and son. Rowan Jacobson writes about food and the environment. When I spoke to him last week, I asked how he came to have these two particular interests.
There's people who are interested in food just because they want to be served good food and sort of be entertained by food. I've never cared about that, but I've always liked how food connects us to the natural world. Like, all the food we eat, at some point, before it was messed with, was part of the natural world, right? Even if it's part of agriculture, you know? It was a living plant or animal. And so it's a way in which we're still vitally connected to the world at large. And so I think we can kind of... food is actually a great way of understanding why we like what we like, and sort of understanding, you know, what we came out of, and even after thousands of years of civilization, sort of the driving influences are the same as they've always been.
Okay, and are you a cook?
Yes, and I do a lot of cooking myself.
Okay, you do. And do you have like a science background, or what's your background?
I started college as a joint physics and literature major. I went to kind of a kooky college where you could do that. Yeah. But then I abandoned the physics part of it pretty fast because all those classes were early in the morning and the literature classes were all late in the afternoon.
So this is the true story of how you came to be who you are.
Yeah, pretty much.
The later classes in the day.
Yeah, absolutely. But anyway, yeah, but I've always had a lot of interest in science. A lot of people are bored by science because it's so poorly presented, I think, in schools.
Mm-hmm.
But it can actually, it's a very compelling subject if done right.
So your latest book is The Living Shore, and I'm wondering if you can talk about what inspired you to write The Living Shore.
Well, I guess that really started a couple of years earlier when I wrote a book called A Geography of Oysters, which was a consumer's guide to the whole world of oysters. There's probably about 300 different varieties of oysters in North America.
Mm-hmm.
And what makes them all different, they all taste different, and what makes them different is whatever's going on in the bay that they come from. Oysters are, I think of them as kind of like a lens, a way of focusing everything that's going on in a bay into, you know, a little morsel. Because they're filter feeders, they just filter water through their bodies all day to eat. And so they will pick up influences from their environment really well. And I thought that was fascinating, the way that they're all different because of their environment. It's kind of like the French word terroir, which is used with wine, which means the taste of place.
Right.
It's really true with oysters. So I thought it was kind of a great way to explore the coast of North America through the oysters. So I did that book, which had a little bit of ecology in it, but mostly it was just about the joy of eating oysters.
And it had recipes and...
It did have a few recipes. I set it up just like a wine guide, okay, only for oysters, where you've got each region and then went through the regions and explored, tried to get down to the heart of what made them all different, and ended up sort of getting into geology sometimes to understand the factors that were actually making the oysters taste like they did. So, during the writing of that book, I met a woman named Betsy Peabody, who runs the Puget Sound Restoration Fund in Puget Sound, which works to restore the Puget Sound ecosystem. And she works a lot with oysters because oysters are kind of like a key component of that ecosystem. Anyway, so I met Betsy. I got to taste a couple different oysters growing in Puget Sound that are projects that she's involved in. So then we had kept in touch. And then she let me know that they were going up to British Columbia because the oyster that's native to Puget Sound is called the Olympia oyster. And it's almost gone. It's been almost completely wiped out from the Pacific coast of North America. So it's kind of... When Betsy's attempting to restore Olympia oyster beds in Puget Sound, she doesn't know what that end product should look like. There's no model to shoot for. Or so she thought. Then she found out that up in British Columbia, on the remote coast of Vancouver Island, were a couple of pristine beds of these oysters. So she teamed up with the Nature Conservancy and Department of Fisheries and Oceans in Canada to launch this expedition to go study those beds and come up with kind of a role model for what beds in Puget Sound and California and elsewhere could eventually be. Mm-hmm. And so I heard about that trip and kind of talked my way aboard.
Okay.
Because it just sounded like a fascinating chance to sort of go back in time and see what things were like on the Pacific coast
right.
a couple hundred years ago.
So you weren't just there as a writer, you were sort of working as a member of a team.
Well, I was there too. She was happy to have me along because, you know, she thought it would be nice to have somebody documenting what they were doing and sort of taking the big picture approach, because mostly they were scientists and they were determined with the minutia, how many oysters per square meter were there, what were they living on, stuff like that. But you know, it was only they, you know, it was a small group that got to go up there, so everybody had to pitch in and do the grunt work, which okay. you know, involved hours of counting oysters on beaches and measuring oysters with calipers, so you had to figure out the populations, like how old was each segment of the population.
Right, right.
So yeah, so there, I was definitely like...
So you got involved in all that as well.
Yeah, suckered into the grunt work.
Because you got space on the boat, so...
Right,
you have to
right,
help. Yeah. Okay. The opening of the book called Tides, I thought that was just beautiful. It's just really lovely prose, and I was thinking I might just read a little bit of it, if that's okay with you.
Fine with me.
So this is from the very beginning of the book. When the full moon hauls back the waters, they emerge, a glittering band along the shore like doubloons washed up from the wreck of a Spanish galleon. They close their shells tight and for a few hours become three woods and small fish that live. Since you might box just another cobblestone rather than acre line. I just thought it was beautiful. It was really,
thank you.
Really lovely. Did you write that while you were on the trip?
No.
Did you write any of the book while you were, or were you mostly just taking notes and thinking about what you wanted?
Yeah, no, I was just scrambling to take notes because I was, you know, spending my day, you know, immersed in water up to my knees.
Helping.
Yeah, there was like nowhere to write anything, much less even take notes practically because everything was wet.
Yeah, and it was only a week long?
Yeah, it was about a week that we were up there. But then, you know, in the evening, I'd scramble to try to, like, just write down everything that happened during the day. And I did take some interviews
okay.
on the boat.
With all the people that were working on the team?
Yeah.
And Betsy, and who else was, like, second in command?
That's a good question. The man who was really leading the trip was a man named Brian Kingsett, who is the one who had actually discovered those beds of oysters
okay, right.
about 14 years previously. And he had done that. He kind of had what I think was the ultimate summer job. Starting in the mid-90s, the province of British Columbia decided that it wanted to survey its coastline for potential beaches that could be used for shellfish aquaculture, for mm-hmm. farming clams mostly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it didn't know what it had. BC has this insane shoreline of thousands and thousands of kilometers, a lot of which really haven't been documented very carefully. So Brian got the job, which ended up taking him, I think, 7 summers, of just cruising the whole coast in a small boat, landing on every single beach, and just quickly documenting it and figuring out what its potential for shellfish farming was. So what he got to do is just explore the entire coast of British Columbia, including all through the fjords. And at a couple different spots on that coast, he found these pristine beds of Olympias, which no one really knew about. And so he was the one who then eventually told Betsy that they were up there, which is when she decided to try to pull together this trip. And since Brian was the only one who had ever seen these beaches and also knew that area better than anyone else, he was kind of leading the trip.
All right.
He's also a marine ecologist at Vancouver Island University, but his role in this trip was definitely as a guide.
Now, did the university fund the trip? I'm curious.
The university threw in the boat. They have a special boat that is designed for shellfish research. Mm-hmm. It's got lots of cool tools that make the job easier. So the university threw in the boat, and the funding came from the Restoration Fund and the Nature Conservancy, and the Canada's Department of Fisheries and Oceans provided the official sign-off that we were allowed to actually be there and take some of the oysters for studying.
Okay, all right. I loved the Jonathan Swift quote that you include in the book. He was a bold man that first eat an oyster. I thought that was such a great quote because it's such an unusual looking thing to think that anyone would put this in their mouth. They had to have been really hungry.
Right. I think the first one, you wouldn't think food when you looked right at it. But after, if you're hungry enough, you'd start to think.
Right.
I wonder if I could do something with that.
Now, why are oysters not generally cooked when they're... I mean, I know that sometimes they're cooked, but generally they're eaten raw. Is that just because that's how the flavor is most likely to come out?
Yeah, I think bad things happen to oysters when you cook. I mean, there's certainly great traditions of cooking oysters. You know, you get po' boys in New Orleans and oysters Rockefeller, which, you know, has its pluses and minuses. and oyster stew. There's a big tradition of oyster cookery, but there's something special about the raw ones, and it seems like people have always found that. The Romans were obsessed with raw oysters. French have always been obsessed with raw oysters. Yeah. And I think it's something about that vitality that it's... There's a quote from a French surrealist poet that says, eating an oyster is like kissing the sea on the lips.
Right.
So it's kind of like that.
Could you read from The Living Shore? Would you?
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Yeah.
I think I'll read a section that needs maybe a tiny bit of setup. As I said, these oyster beds that we went to study were in the fjords on a pretty remote stretch of Vancouver Island, so it took quite a few hours of boating to get to the area. And I get this section happens as we've gotten the boat in the water and we're boating through the fjords, and evening has come. As we pressed on into graying light and softening forms, the white V of our wake glowing behind us, I wondered if these fjords were unraveling. Could their integrity survive the clear cuts and declining salmon? They certainly felt intact. There was a grandeur that you just don't find back east. In 1853, when oysters were already being extirpated from many of their traditional haunts on the east coast, Theodore Winthrop could still write in The Canoe and the Saddle, "Civilized mankind has never yet had a fresh chance of developing itself under grand and stirring influences so large as in the Northwest. For the most part, the fresh chance is long gone. We remade most of the Northwest using the same model we employed elsewhere. We tamed it in ways we are no longer even aware of. The BC coast used to be thick with 30-foot basking sharks, which slowly cruised the surface, feeding on plankton. So many boats collided with the sharks or had their fishing gear snagged by the giants that in 1945, the Canadian government began an eradication program. Boats outfitted with razor-sharp prows, looking like Phoenician warships, were sent out to run through as many sharks as possible. This went on for 25 years. In 2008, the government initiated a program to help the sharks recover, but so far none has been found, and our experience of the waters of the Northwest has fundamentally changed. But we haven't quite finished the job. Here and there, the grand and stirring influences still make themselves felt. It was easy to imagine ghost whispers swirling around the Atrevida, whose namesake is a Spanish corvette that spent several months sailing these very inlets in 1791. We were heading in the opposite direction, coming from the land to explore the coast, and we sought shellfish, not otters, but we still seemed connected to those earlier and larger missions, our fractalized adventure, a tiny spur molded by the same waveforms that have shaped all natural and human history in this region. And some of those connections were still intact. Not far north of us, the vertiginous Brooks Peninsula jutted 9 miles into the Pacific. Its unassailable flanks deflected both the glaciers of the last ice age and human intrusion of any kind. In a world shrunken by intercontinental air travel, lost worlds still exist, the Royal British Columbia Museum's Richard Hebda writes. One of these, virtually on our own doorstep, is the Brooks Peninsula. The peninsula harbors species dating back in an unbroken lineage to the Pleistocene. It's a treasure chest of DNA. Whatever forgotten worlds lay waiting to be rediscovered would remain hidden to us that night, for we lost the sun long before we found the Nuchatlet's channel. To call it a channel is generous. When the glaciers were done whittling the Nootka Island fjords, they tossed the whittlings at the edge of the sea. Those are the Nuchatlet's islands, discarded in the tides like some giant child's game of jacks. The full moon saved us. Without its wattage, we'd have been forced to spend the night at anchor. But soon the inky blackness was lit by a cosmic headlamp rising over Vancouver Island. It wasn't quite coincidental. The dates of our trip had been picked to coincide with the full moon, which provides the lowest tides of summer. But the clear skies were pure luck. We inched through the channel, praying that the GPS hadn't overlooked anything. And then we spotted a fire in the distance, on the beach. Brian Kingsett crept close in the inflatable. Two members of the New Chanu tribe, whose ancestors had greeted Cook 230 years earlier, said, "Hey." If they noted any irony in this visit of the Atrevida, they didn't show it. Sure, they knew Bob. Bob was the man whose camp we were staying at. No idea if he was around or not. "Could you get to his place from here?" "Sure, but he lives around the other side of the island. You have to follow a shallow little channel." "Go around," they told us. "Go around." And so it was that at midnight, after 19 hours of travel by car, ferry, and boat, Joff Davis and I found ourselves leaning over the front of the inflatable, figureheads and headlamps, calling out rocks as we led the Atrevida creeping through the reefs while the Pacific swell rolled in behind us. "All clear in front. Wait, too shallow. Back up. Rock. Oh, sorry, that's kelp." And so on. At last we rounded a corner in the channel, and there, breaking the surface glint, was Bob DeVoe's wooden boat, the Nootka Rose, tied up to its floating dock. We snugged the Atrevida alongside the Nootka Rose and piled out to collapse in Bob's living room and guest cabin and in tents on his lawn. I opted for a little berth on the Nootka Rose, but after those hours of hypervigilance, I couldn't sleep. I sat on the Nootka Rose's deck and watched the moonlight play across the lagoon surface in white arcs and listened to the waves crash against rocks on the other end of the island. Occasionally something slapped at the surface or stirred in the night. I strained my ears trying to pick up any revenants, but I was new here and didn't know what to listen for.
Thank you very much. That's great. So it wouldn't have made sense to just sort of stop somewhere else and then try to find it in the daylight?
There really was nowhere to stop.
There was nowhere to stop.
The way those fjords are, they're like just these super deep channels,
right?
So you've got like mountains on both sides of you, and
the whole time
nowhere you can drop an anchor.
Yeah. We're just coming out of a phase of full moon earlier this week, and it really is very striking reading this and thinking about just how much of a difference that would make. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. And if you're out in the night for a while, just you get used to the full moon, then you start to wonder why people have lights at all,
Yeah, right.
Of course, when the moon's not out there, it's a whole different story.
Yeah. You mentioned at one point in the book that John Steinbeck was the unlikely guiding spirit for this journey. I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about his link to this work and his own environmental concerns.
Yeah, Steinbeck, people think of Grapes of Wrath,
yeah.
Cannery Row, but he had a strong interest in science and particularly in marine ecology. And he, I think in the 1940s, fresh off the success of Grapes of Wrath, he and his pal Ed Ricketts, who figured in a lot of his writing, who was a scientists, they decided to go study marine invertebrates along the Baja Peninsula. And the Sea of Cortez was the name, the log from the Sea of Cortez was the name of the book that was eventually published about this trip. It was not nearly as successful as most of Steinbeck's stuff. The Sea of Cortez is the water body inside that peninsula. So yeah, they headed out from California and went and spent a few weeks studying invertebrates, which really hadn't been done at all back then. They were totally ahead of their time. And also, I think, spending a great deal of time at the bars along the way. But, it's like, how many books have been written about collecting invertebrates along the Pacific coast. How many general interest books? It's not many. So he was a clear influence. And he also, because he had done that during World War II, it was kind of interesting. He definitely had this sense of trying to justify, you know, why he was studying such little tiny creatures and what possible significance this could have for the world at this time when there were these huge earth-shaking events going on.
Right.
And so, and we have, like, you know, when you're, if you're Betsy Peabody and you're trying to explain to people why this tiny oyster the size of a half dollar is at all important, you kind of have those same challenges.
Yeah. So why is this so important? And I know that you, we talked a little bit about how oysters are like a filtration system. And I know that that affects the larger picture. I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Scientists actually refer to oysters as ecosystem engineers. We've all heard about how coral reefs are, we've gotten used to understanding that coral reefs are kind of the keys to the health of that whole tropical marine world. And oyster reefs play pretty much the exact same role in the temperate waters and are actually more endangered than coral reefs, but they just haven't gotten the attention. The Nature Conservancy is now trying to, that's a big new push for them, is trying to get people educated about the role of oyster reefs. They really are, they're kind of like the base from which that whole coastal ecosystem arises. Not only do they filter the water, which makes it clear so that sunlight can penetrate to the bottom, which allows seagrasses to grow, and a lot of fish and invertebrates live in those seagrass beds. They use them for shelter, or they use the oyster reefs for shelter. So oyster reefs do all that. They also stabilize the bottom. They prevent erosion from taking place. Mm-hmm. And that. So when you've got the oysters in those estuaries, you have clear water, healthy seagrass communities, and then all of the creatures that need that habitat to live in, and then all the creatures that eat the creatures that live in that habitat, or that grow up to be, you know, that start off in living in that world when they're juveniles and then grow up to be fish that we eat. So pretty much the entire marine community uses these coastal areas. The places out in the deep ocean are much less productive, and there isn't that much life that lives out there full time. But, of course, we over-harvested the oysters as soon as we made it to North America, and so that's part of the reason that we have so many declining fish stocks and such. All the algae blooms and dead zones on the coasts are all because that estuary isn't there anymore.
I was really so disappointed to read about the condition of the Chesapeake Bay. You were talking about the Chesapeake Bay in your book.
Yeah.
And you said that the reasons for the decline of the Chesapeake Bay are threefold. They stripped the land, and that created erosion, correct?
Right. Well, the way it's supposed to work is you've got trees on the banks of all the rivers upstream, and then you've got wetlands that kind of act as a big sponge and filtration system, so that the water that actually goes into the estuaries doesn't have that many nutrients in it. Today, like because of agriculture mostly and cities, we've sort of pulled out that whole filtration system so that the water that goes into all of our estuaries is just filled with nutrients from upstream, either sewage runoff from cities or from agriculture. But what all those nutrients are fertilizer for plants, and in the plants, in the sea, the plants are single-celled algae. So those nutrients fuel these huge algae blooms that we see, not just in the Chesapeake, but over the Gulf of Mexico and on the Pacific coast, too. And those algae blooms, as that algae dies and decays, it sucks up all the oxygen, so then all the fish and crabs die, too. Mm-hmm. So you lose the whole ecosystem. But the way it's supposed to work is the water that's flowing into the estuaries is fairly low in nutrients already, and the nutrients that are there fertilize just enough algae for the shellfish to eat. So the water stays clear, and the shellfish are also passing that food energy up the food chain.
Right.
They're one of the main ways that we go from microbial food to higher, more complex organisms. And what's happening, like once you pull that connection out, you just never get all the food energy going up from the microbe level. And this one researcher, Jeremy Jackson, refers to that as the rise of slime, and warns that, you know, the future of the, not just the Chesapeake, but all the coasts is one dominated by single-celled microbes and jellyfish, and, yeah. and that's about it.
It was really discouraging to read about that. And also, you mentioned that Maryland crab cakes are mostly made with crabs from Asia at this point.
Oh, yeah, they just don't have, it's not an environment that they can thrive in anymore.
Yeah.
But there is hope. Part of the reason I was excited to write this book, my previous book was called Fruitless Fall, and it was about the honeybee collapse, and I really don't see a whole lot of hope on that issue. It's kind of depressing going to various presentations and telling people there's no hope. With oyster restoration, there seems to be a real hope. Things are really starting to turn. Even in the Chesapeake, which has been kind of like the poster child for failing ecosystems, they've spent about $60 million trying to restore the oysters and haven't had any success. But now, just within the last year, they're starting to get beds coming back, mostly in sort of the sheltered river mm-hmm. mouths. So things are looking hopeful. And all across the country, there are so many oyster restoration efforts that are doing very well, with oysters appearing in places they haven't been seen in decades or centuries.
Now, does that work hand-in-hand with regulation to keep it from happening again? You know, when they're...
Yes. Obviously, you can't...
You can't revive
oysters
it and then...
as fast as you grow them, which was part of the problem in the Chesapeake, was
right.
that because...
That was how they identified
government
themselves.
Hand A wasn't having anything to do with government hand B, as fast as they were throwing oysters into the Chesapeake,
right.
the watermen were harvesting them for sale, which was an insane system. But yeah, and that's changed. It looks like it's about to change. But in other places, yeah, the oysters are off limits.
Who's doing that well?
Well, the restoration efforts are going very well in Puget Sound. Wellfleet Harbor now has oysters coming back. Florida has some very successful oyster restoration programs.
Mm-hmm.
Gulf of Mexico has places where they've reestablished reefs, but they're also continuing to harvest. The Gulf of Mexico is really the last place in the country with an abundance of wild oysters, where the oyster reefs are still really strong. And they are still getting harvested too fast.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't enough wild oysters left anywhere else to really sustain any sort of an industry.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why it's kind of easier to do the restoration efforts, because anyone who made their living off the wild oysters is gone.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about writing. I'm curious how you organize yourself, and also do you tend to know the structure of a book before you start a first draft, or does that sort of evolve as you work?
It evolves a little bit, but I do pretty much... The thing about nonfiction is that you sell nonfiction on a book proposal,
mm-hmm.
so it's very different than fiction, where you have to write the whole damn thing first before you find out whether anyone
right.
will buy it from you, which scared the daylights out of me. But nonfiction, you put together a book proposal which has a couple sample chapters, an annotated table of contents, things like that. And then you get a contract based on that. So at that point, you spent maybe a month thinking about the structure of the book, because you had to create this table of contents that made sense, and you've written overviews and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So you really have a nice template to work from. And I think some people tend to not put that much time into the proposal part of it, because it doesn't feel like it's anything real yet. But I feel like that's kind of the key. A, because you get your contract based on that, and B, because if you do a really good job in that, then you're off and running. So
now, what happens in interactions with the publisher if you decide as you're going that your template really doesn't work as well as you thought? Are they usually pretty open-minded about things changing, or has that not really been an issue for you ever as far as the structure?
I'd say they usually have no memory of what your book proposal looked like, because they're looking at, you know, 100 book proposals.
Right, right.
If it, like, was vastly different than what you had submitted in the proposal, then that might be a problem.
Right.
And I think that actually happens fairly regularly, okay. that proposals end up being misleading. But mine, I usually haven't changed drastically from my proposals.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When you write a book like The Living Shore or like Fruitless Fall, which, as you mentioned, is about the decline of the honeybees. Are you trying to write for the general public, or do you assume you're writing for a reader who's already somewhat well-versed in the science and the vocabulary? And
no, I'm definitely writing for the general public.
So do you spend a lot of time trying to figure out how you're going to make everything accessible, or do you find that that comes pretty easily?
I think it comes fairly easily, but that's definitely an important part of it. I want to make sure that not only is it accessible, but that it's interesting and entertaining. I don't want it to be like homework for people.
Right. Well, you mentioned how science sometimes comes across as pretty dry.
Right.
Certainly when it's written for high school textbooks or something like that. So.
Yeah. No, I always think, is this going to be interesting for anyone other than me? I mean, that's important. I think too few people think about that.
Do you have other readers that you'll show it to before you show it to an agent or an editor?
My wife. Mm-hmm. She's always great about looking through everything and getting back to me. And in many ways, she has different interests than I do.
Oh, that's
I mean,
true.
In a sense, I'm my ideal reader, right?
Right.
I'm writing for me, but like a book that I would like to read. But it's really great then to get her perspective, and because most people out there aren't necessarily going to be just like me. So then usually after I get her feedback, I'm able to open up the book in certain ways.
Okay.
To address a broader crowd.
Who is Mary Elder Jacobson?
That's my wife.
Oh, that is your wife. Yeah. So she does the illustrations.
She did. She did the illustrations for The Living Shore, and she did a few in Fruitless Fall.
So they're great. I really enjoyed seeing that and wondered if you had presented the book as a whole, as a single piece with the illustrations, or if that was a separate...
It wasn't part of the proposal, but I definitely said to my... Like, for this book in particular, I had a vision of what it could be like. It was going to be... I wanted to write a fairly small book. Mm-hmm. I didn't want it to be heavy-handed. I wanted to just sort of be impressionistic and just get give people these basic concepts, which are new to a lot of people. Most people haven't been thinking about coastal ecosystems at all, or what the coast used to be like hundreds of years ago. So I didn't want it to be any kind of a tome. I just wanted to just sort of get that conversation started,
mm-hmm.
and want it to be light and maybe a little bit more poetic than my other books had been. So I definitely pictured it with... My wife's done a lot of illustrations, and she has kind of a whimsical touch with them.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it would be a perfect combination.
Yeah, they're wonderful.
And the publisher really came through. They did. They made it into a really nice package, which you never know what it's going to be like until you see it. And
yeah.
I was happy with this one.
I didn't notice. Did you take the cover photograph?
No, I did the interior photographs.
Yeah, and those were beautiful.
And the cover looks, you can tell, it's the exact same spot. That whoever the cover designer was, the cover designers, they usually just order, get photos from stock agencies.
Right.
And, man, 9 times out of 10, it couldn't be less appropriate for whatever...
right.
You know, they think about what's going to look good. They don't necessarily think about content. They usually haven't actually read the content. That's just like... You know, they're artists. They don't want to have to deal with that stuff. So I was like, and this is clearly the exact same part of the world. There's nowhere else that looks quite like that. So I was really thrilled with this cover.
That's great. Yeah, it's a wonderful.
Except the funny thing is, you know, there's starfish on the cover, right? Which are oysters' worst nightmares. So if you're an oyster, this cover, like for people, this is like, ooh, what a beautiful cover. But for an oyster, this would be like Night of the Living Dead.
Like, well, maybe that's part of why it's there.
Yeah, right.
Actually, you mentioned the starfish, and I did not know that they call starfish sea stars now. When did that happen?
Yeah, sea stars and sun stars, because they're not fish, right? So some scientists decided they had to get scientific about these things, and you couldn't call them fish anymore.
Oh, so really, that's like officially now the name is sea stars.
Oh, yeah, like they all corrected me when I tried to call them starfish. But the sun stars really bugs me, because there's not even any sea reference there. It's almost, you know,
what
redundant.
What are sun stars?
Those are sun stars on the cover there. Yeah, just what you think of as starfish.
Okay, and sea stars are what?
Same thing.
Certain
ones are sun stars, certain ones are sea stars. It makes no sense. But people also don't realize that starfish are just shellfish-consuming machines. You know, they look pretty and slow, but they can just tear through a bed of oysters. Kind of like a tornado going through a trailer park.
Wow. So how do they pry them apart?
They have all those suckers, right?
Yeah.
Underneath. So they just wrap their arms around and pull, and it can take a couple hours. You know, the oyster's resisting, but the starfish has all the time in the world. So the starfish always wins, and as soon as it gets the shell just a little bit open, it actually everts its stomach outside of its body and into the oyster shell and secretes digestive juices and digests the oyster in its own shell and then just slurps it all back in.
Wow.
So it's a bad way to go.
Well, that reminds me of something I read about eating oysters, which was that you had suggested eating oysters with a predator's mentality.
Right, yeah. Think like a starfish. Don't invert your own stomach, but it definitely helps to think like a starfish.
So I loved that because the question that had been asked of you was how to eat oysters gracefully and, you know, with etiquette, and you were sort of like, don't.
Right, yeah, there's really two schools of thought. One is that oysters need, you know, white linen and champagne and those tiny little forks. Yeah, and, you know, that's like clearly trying to divorce yourself from what it's all about. And the other school is just, you know, sit on the beach, open the oysters and
slurp
and, you know, get oyster juice all over your shirt.
So I have a few oyster questions. One is, how did oysters become the food of celebration?
You know, it goes with that whole aphrodisiac.
That's myth. One of my other questions.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. We'll tie them together.
So tie them together.
One, the processed food, right? Any kind of food where you have to work and like it's kind of like, it's like treasure or something. You got to get through the box to get to the goodie inside.
Right.
There's something celebratory about that. But also, it's just like oysters make people feel really good. I've had this conversation with a million different people. They're like, wow, what is it? It's like a drug. And you start to feel like you could do anything. And I actually believe that it's probably the DHA, the omega-3s in the oyster, mm-hmm. among other things. Mm-hmm. There's probably something else going on that no one knows about yet. But they're just like the perfect food in terms of human nutrition, what we need. So your whole body is just revving on whatever is in that oyster.
So that's the answer.
Yeah, it just makes people feel great.
Great.
And also, they tend to be expensive
yeah.
in certain parts of the world. So,
it's,
you know,
a
like truffles.
Right, caviar.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And my other question about oyster rumors, is there any truth to the idea that drinking vodka while eating oysters lessens the risk of contracting hepatitis A?
Yeah, I don't think so.
No?
I can't imagine that it would. I mean, maybe if you drank so much vodka that your stomach, you know, was really, like, everything in your stomach was really sitting in a big vat of vodka for a while. But the thing is, your stomach is hitting everything that goes into it with serious acid, right?
Right.
So anything that can survive that can probably survive the vodka, too.
That makes sense. Your next book is titled American Terroir.
Yep.
So what will that be about? Is that about wine?
No, it's got one chapter on wine.
But okay.
It's kind of, when I was doing the oyster book, as I mentioned earlier,
right.
I sort of realized that the way to approach oysters was this concept of terroir, which I borrowed from the wine world, which is the taste of place, that the same thing grown in two different places will be different based on the soil, the climate, and all kinds of other factors
right.
in that place. And basically, that concept had been applied to wine for a very long time. The Romans were very insistent on getting, you know, wine from certain vineyards and mm-hmm. their oysters from Bordeaux and so on. And cheeses, France had a whole system for saying that, you know, Roquefort could only be from these caves in southern France because of the molds that grew there that made the cheese what it is. But really, that concept hadn't really expanded beyond wine and a little bit of cheese. But I, when I was using it for oysters, I realized, wow, this really applies to lots of other things, too.
Lots of things.
So, yeah, so American Terroir, each chapter focuses on a different food in America where you can make the case that the place really makes the food what it is.
And how many chapters will there be? Have you identified all the foods that you're going to cover?
Yeah, which was more than I could really... there'll be 10 chapters that really go in depth, and I try to get to the essence of the food. There's a chapter on maple syrup. I don't know, have you heard about the project at UVM where they've been looking at bedrock to see
yes.
if differences in bedrock come through in the flavor of the maple syrup.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it looks like there probably are some factors there.
Okay.
But certainly different maple, you know, everybody has their favorite maple syrup producer. So yeah. Syrup is different based on where it's growing. Salmon, every river has a very different salmon because based on the characteristics of the river.
Mm-hmm.
And there's certainly a chapter on wine, a chapter on cheese.
Yeah. On Route 15, when you're heading up toward Jeffersonville, mm-hmm. there's a vineyard that's in the middle of a graveyard. And every time we go by, we get hysterical because it's just like, if this is true about the terroir,
yeah, right.
What's that taste like?
That's very interesting.
It's very odd. So when does American Terroir come out?
Next fall.
And is it published by Bloomsbury?
Yep, it'll be Bloomsbury again.
Okay. So I'm wondering if, are there any certain writers or scientists that have been influential in your growth as a writer?
I think the first writer that I think I read and I thought, wow, you can do this, was David Quammen, who he used to have a column in, I think it was an Outside magazine,
uh-huh.
a column on natural science, and it was always funny. He anthropomorphized a lot of animals.
What's his last name again?
Quammen.
Quammen. Okay.
And I find myself, I do, like he was funny but serious at the same time.
Uh-huh.
And which is, and I often find myself sort of writing in that mode.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily consciously, it's just kind of how I tend to think about things.
Yeah, which is probably why you liked his writing in the first place.
Right. But it's the kind of thing that people say you shouldn't do in a way. Like, people feel like you shouldn't be funny about a serious subject.
Mm-hmm.
And being funny about science, people used to have more problems with that, and now it's getting more common.
That's interesting. I wonder if that's more true for nonfiction writers, that they're going to receive that criticism because they're supposed to be so serious.
Yeah, that could be.
Because clearly fiction writers are constantly being funny within serious contexts.
Right, exactly. But yeah, with nonfiction, it's more unusual.
So does he have books as well, or
yes,
he's a columnist?
He's done quite a few books. I think The Song of the Dodo is probably his best known.
Okay, book. All right.
Well, this wasn't really an influence, but I realized when I was working on the oyster book, and to really to get down to the root of what was making some of these oysters different, I ended up looking at geology. Because it's kind of where it all starts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in American Terroir, it's the same thing. Like, to understand why these things are different, it all started with the glaciers and the movement of the plates before that, which sort of set everything in motion that made us end up where we are today with the environments that we have today. So I've just lately been reading a lot of John McPhee,
mm-hmm.
and I've kind of realized that the greatest work on terroir ever written is John McPhee's magnum opus, Annals of the Former World, which is kind of a collection of those books that he did mostly as New Yorker pieces. He traveled the country talking about the geology of each region, but showing it how the lives of the people today are still completely being, like, the patterns of those lives are all totally because of the geology and the natural conditions. So I'm kind of doing, for food what he did for the rest of the country.
How long might it take you to revise a book like The Living Shore? How long were you working on this once you started writing it?
This one was fast. It's a pretty small book. That trip was last July.
July of 08.
And I got started right away on the book. And I think I delivered it in January. So it was about 6 months of work.
Wow.
And the revisions are usually pretty light. Revision is fast.
Mm-hmm.
You get feedback from your editor, and, I just kind of pretend like she's giving me somebody else's manuscript to work on.
Oh, okay. So my last question for writers is always the same. What advice do you have for writers who occasionally get stuck in their work or have trouble moving forward?
Yeah, that doesn't happen to me very often. I think it's because I actually got started as a ghostwriter.
Mm-hmm.
I ghostwrote a lot of books for people.
So you were ghostwriting for scientists or something like that who weren't necessarily writers?
Yeah, people weren't necessarily writers, but all kinds of different people. Some of them were, fitness gurus, all kinds of stuff. But when you're ghostwriting, it definitely gets the whole ego issue out of the way because it's so clearly not about you, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And maybe because that's how I got started, I've never worried about like, I'm never taking myself too seriously when I'm doing it. And I think a lot, like, when you get, if you get stuck on writing, it's because you're taking yourself too seriously.
Okay.
So, and like ghostwriting, you really got to get it done, so.
Because you get that deadline.
Right. So, yeah, you just, I just, you know, sometimes it's a day of really crappy writing, but that's more, that happens to be more than a day of, like, no writing.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks, it was a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Rowan Jacobson. Next week, Write the Book will be on a brief hiatus, but tune in on the 28th to hear an interview with Vermont novelist Robert Cohen, author of the book Amateur Barbarians. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group, and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. More information is available at autismsupportdaily.com or 802-985-8773. And by the Lake Champlain Regional Chamber of Commerce, promoting and supporting a healthy environment that makes Burlington the ideal place to live, work, visit, and do business, located at 60 Main Street in Burlington and online at vermont.org. And by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, building a brand new economy with old-fashioned values. Learn more at vbsr.org. And by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic network. There's quite a lot going on for the Bookworms calendar this week. Radical Simplicity author Jim Merkel holds an ecological footprint workshop tonight at 5:30 at the Bugby Senior Center in White River Junction. Bill Schubart, author of the Lamoille stories, Uncle Benoit's Wake, and other tales from Vermont, will be at the Fletcher Free Library in Burlington for a Booked for Lunch session Thursday, September 17th from 12 to 1. Local author and beekeeper Ross Conrad discusses the future of the honeybee Thursday, September 17th at 7 at the Lincoln Library in Lincoln. The Dorothy Alling Memorial Library in Williston holds its Brown Bag Book Club on Friday, September 18th at 12:30. Patrons pack their own lunches and come together to discuss a book. This month, the conversation centers around Julie Otsuka's When the Emperor Was Divine. Author and business consultant Bruce Piasecki discusses his newest book, World Inc., Friday, September 18th at 10:45 at Green Mountain College in Putney. Vermont author Gary Kowalski discusses his most recent book, Science and the Search for God, Sunday, September 20th at 7:30 at the Unitarian Church in Burlington. More information is available at 802-862-5630, extension 24. Naturalist Jesse Moore leads visitors on a guided hike in the footsteps of author Roland E. Robinson in Speaking Truth to Power, Abolitionist Speeches, Sunday, September 20th at 2 at the Rokeby Museum in Ferrisburg. The Dorothy Alling Memorial Library hosts our stories past, present, and future on September 21st from 12:30 to 2:30. Leader Racile Hamrell discusses the use of storytelling as an effective tool to promote health and growth, build community, and facilitate change in family, social, and work lives. Author and journalist Paul Roberts discusses the interplay of economics, technology, and nature in the future of food in a peak oil world, Monday, September 21st at 5 at UVM's Davis Center in Burlington. Today's Write the Book prompt was inspired by the interview you heard today with Rowan Jacobson. In his book, The Living Shore, Rowan talks about children at play being powerhouses of creativity. He refers to the science essayist Lewis Thomas, who suggests that earliest language was probably developed by children. In Thomas's book, The Fragile Species, he writes, "It probably began when the earliest settlements, or the earliest nomadic tribes, reached a sufficient density of population so that there were plenty of very young children in close contact with each other, a critical mass of children playing together all day long." Today's prompt, then, is twofold. First, try to let go of your adult sensibilities and get playful as you write. Because it is as children that we best access the possibilities of language. The second part of today's prompt is about oysters. Recall Jonathan Swift's words, "He was a bold man that first eat an oyster." Write about that person. Who was the first person who ate an oyster? What was his or her situation and state of mind to be that bold? A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or news of events that might be of interest to readers, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And now stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby is up next with The World of Music, and that's at 3 o'clock. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.